If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
According to campaign finance records, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg has spent $300,000 on private plane travel, while Bernie Sanders just asked Spirit Airlines if they have a punch card.
Every tenth ride should be free.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today, you'll hear Seth's recent interviews with presidential hopefuls Cory Booker and Beto O'Rourke. But first, a closer look.
Yesterday, the man who oversaw a two-year investigation into a criminal operation by a foreign government to interfere in a presidential election testified before Congress on national television, and right off the bat, he made headlines when he said this.
Did you actually totally exonerate the president?
No.
Under Department of Justice policy, the president could be prosecuted for obstruction of justice crimes after he leaves office, is correct?
True.
Man, he was quick on the draw with that answer. It's like he's been waiting 2 years for someone to ask him that question. And do you have the handcuffs picked out? Yes! Over the course of 7 hours, Mueller laid out details of a criminal attempt to interfere in a presidential election, a campaign that openly welcomed and encouraged that interference and a series of lies and potential attempts to obstruct justice by the president and his aides. In normal times, that would be incredibly damning, and yet we're all so numb to everything, people are acting like because Mueller didn't come out and say the words Trump is guilty, it wasn't a big deal. But what were you expecting? Did you think Mueller was going to smash through the wall in a monster truck called the Detrumpulator? Mueller's report in itself is already damning. We just got to see him explain it on national TV. Yes, he occasionally stumbled or had to consult the report, but it's over 400 pages with footnotes and citations. If you asked me under oath about something I said in a closer look yesterday, I'd have to consult the script, too. Let's see. I'd like to refer to you to Appendix C, subsection 43B, where, in a closer look, we played a clip of Elizabeth Warren saying the words...
Crazy
Also, it's pretty rich when the people who complain that Mueller stumbled over details in a 400-page report are the same people who are totally fine with Mr. Details over here.
This will be a plan where you can choose your doctor. This will be a plan where you can choose your plan. And you know what the plan is. This is the plan.
I mean, it's very easy not to stumble when you're just using the same five words over and over again. But give him something trickier, like the word lawmakers, and then see what happens.
He has worked in both houses of Congress advising lawmakers.
The lawmaker, of course, being the Sharpie that every judge uses to write out their legal decision. Thank you, lawmaker.
Of course, Mueller's very straightforward claim that he could not exonerate the president comes after months of Trump claiming unequivocally that the Mueller report completely and totally exonerated him.
There was no collusion with Russia. There was no obstruction
and none whatsoever. And it was a complete and total exoneration.
No collusion, no obstruction, complete and total exoneration. Keep America great.
Total exoneration, complete vindication.
And hey, you know, in this case, you gotta believe Trump because he definitely read the report, right?
I have not read the Mueller report. I haven't seen the Mueller report. As far as I'm concerned, I don't care about the Mueller report.
I mean, I'm not surprised he didn't read it, but it's jarring when he just comes out and admits it. He's like a guy at a book club who's had a few glasses of wine going, but I guess if I'm being totally honest, my favorite part of 50 Shades of Grey was the cover because I did not read it. And also, we are out of Pinot.
By the way.
So for 4 months, Trump has been saying the report completely and totally exonerated him. How does he feel now that Mueller said explicitly on national television that he did not exonerate Trump?
There is no such a thing. He didn't have the right to exonerate. And, you know, it's very interesting. People mention exoneration. That was something where he totally folded because he never had the right to exonerate.
Donald Trump has a tell. Whenever he goes, you know, it's very interesting, he's about to lay out some five-star bull. So Mueller made clear that he could not exonerate Trump because that was basically his only option. Mueller couldn't just straight up indict Trump because of Justice Department guidelines that say you can't indict a sitting president. So instead, he basically had to say, we can't exonerate the president, now it's up to Congress. But then Republicans weirdly tried to claim that Mueller didn't have the power to claim someone was either exonerated or not exonerated. One Republican congressman even made a big show at that point using props, but Mueller wasn't having it.
Mr. Mueller, does the attorney general have the power or authority to exonerate? Now, what I'm putting up here is the United States Code. This is where the attorney general gets his power, and the Constitution, and the annotated cases of these, which we've searched. We even went to your law school, because I went to Case Western, but I thought maybe your law school teaches it differently. And we got the criminal law textbook from your law school. Mr. Mueller, nowhere in these, because we had them scanned, is there a process or description on exonerate? There's no office of exoneration at the Attorney General's office. There's no certificate at the bottom of his desk. Mr. Mueller, would you agree with me that the Attorney General does not have the power to exonerate?
I'm going to pass on that.
Oh, it's such a bummer when you bust out all your books and the other guy doesn't care. I feel so bad for the staff that had to get all that stuff. I feel like this isn't going to work out the way you think it will. Oh, trust me. When he sees the books, his head will explode. I'm going to be like, you remember this one from your law school? Of course, no matter what Mueller said, nothing was going to stop Trump from declaring victory, which is what he did on his way to an event last night in West Virginia when he once again stopped by reporters for his usual chopper-adjacent cue and yell.
There was no defense of what Robert Mueller was trying to defend, in all fairness to Robert Mueller. Whether his performance was a bad one or a good one, I think everybody understands that. I think everybody understands what's going on. This has been a very bad thing for our country. And despite everything we've been through, it's been an incredible 2.5 years for our country. The administration, our president, me.
Oh, you! You're the president. Well, that explains a lot. Later, Trump was asked about Mueller's assertion that Trump's aides had lied during the investigation. And Trump both denied that Mueller had said that and also claimed the reporter herself was lying by asking the question.
What do you say if Robert Mueller said that you're lying from your investigation?
Let me just tell you something. I know you always have a question.
Lying by White House aides.
You mean my White House aides lied? What about his aides? What about Mueller's aides?
And then your answer was generally untruthful. What do you say to that? He's accusing you.
He didn't say that at all. You're untruthful when you ask. You are untruthful. When you ask that question, you're untruthful. And you know who else is untruthful? His aides.
Why does anyone even ask him questions anymore? It's like continuing to put dollar bills in a jukebox that only plays Achy Breaky Heart no matter what buttons you press. Also, can we go back to this?
What do you say if Robert Mueller said that you're
lying? Let me just tell you something. I know you always have a question.
Yeah, she always has a question. She's a reporter. When the mailman shows up at your door, do you say, oh, let me guess, an envelope? Would a pizza kill you, mailman? Mueller was also asked yesterday about Trump's various attacks on his investigation, and his answers were very clear.
When Donald Trump called your investigation a witch hunt, that was also false, was it not?
I'd like to think so, yes.
Well, your investigation is not a witch hunt, is it?
It is not a witch hunt.
When the president said the Russian interference was a hoax, that was false, wasn't it?
True.
Now, compare that to how Trump reacted just a few hours later.
There was no defense to this ridiculous hoax, this witch hunt that's been going on for a long time. And everybody knew it was a hoax. WikiLeaks is a hoax, just like everything else. And all of those problems having to do with crime were the biggest hoax of all. It was a witch hunt, a total witch hunt. We did nothing wrong. The answer is very simple. Nothing was done wrong. This was all a big hoax.
Okay, I know you watched the hearing, but did you listen? Or did your aide secretly dub over Mueller's lines with Sean Hannity saying nice things about you?
The witch hunt is officially over. The Mueller report is out, and the president of the United States has been totally and completely vindicated.
The president and his allies have immediately started lying about yesterday's hearings because those hearings laid out in clear and unequivocal terms the story of what happened, and that story is incredibly damning. At this point, it's up to Congress to do something about it. They can either stand by and do nothing, or they can impeach.
Our president, me.
This has been A Closer Look. Our guest tonight is a United States senator from New Jersey and a Democratic candidate for president. Please welcome back to the show Senator Cory Booker, everyone.
I'm upset.
Upset about?
You would have me on the show with Fred Savage, for crying out loud. I have beef with Fred Savage.
What is your beef with Fred Savage?
I had this rare moment. I get to go to Comic-Con.
Yes.
This was amazing for me because...
This is out in San Diego.
I literally became a Pac-10 football player just to compensate for the fact that I'm a huge nerd.
Gotcha,
and
right.
I have some balance in my life. And I'm walking through crowded Comic-Con, and somebody comes up to me, Mr. Booker, Fred Savage would like you to have this. And I turn around... And it's a pair of sunglasses. And I'm like, who is this guy I think he is? He's literally giving me shade. Or maybe he thinks he's such a big star. I've never met the guy that I need sunglasses to view him.
Wow.
And so I look around. I go, where's Fred Savage? And they said, well, he would like to see you. And I tried to find him, but I couldn't connect with the guy. So I just see him as one of these stars.
How do you think? I've met him multiple times. He's never given me anything. You should feel lucky
that
you were.
I thought we were going to have a moment backstage, but he did not even.
He didn't even want to see. So you did go to Comic-Con. These are not the sunglasses he gave you, right?
Those are virtual. Gotcha. That is actually our taxpayer dollars. That's okay. NASA.
Uh-huh.
And they were showing people a virtual reality of what it would be like to be on Mars.
Okay.
And I got very afraid that I might have a Matt Damon moment there.
Yeah.
So it was so real, I thought maybe I'll get left behind.
Are there times as you've been running for president that you've thought, Mars doesn't sound so bad?
There's been times, metaphorically, I'd like to send our president.
This is a true story that you have. The nerd gene is strong in you.
Yes.
I think that's one of the nice things.
Yeah, I just want to say this. I had the privilege just this week of getting some campaign support from Leonard Nimoy's widow, Susan Nimoy. So it's
I think it's important to note that I think that even 10, 20 years ago, someone who was sort of out as a nerd would have no chance running for president of this country. I think everything has changed for the better insofar that people who like things like superheroes and science fiction, this is now fully accepted.
We are living the conclusion of the movie Revenge of the Nerds.
Where
it is now very cool to be a nerd. In fact, I try to hide the fact that I was an All-American football player. That does not get me anywhere.
Nobody cares anymore. Yeah,
about that.
But I do, you were talking about... Fred Savage showing you a little bit of shade. We're about, I think, about 10 days out from the next round of Democratic debates. One of the memeable moments from the first night of the debates. Beto O'Rourke, he started speaking Spanish, and you were caught on camera.
Yes.
And that looks like...
Yes.
No, I think... I think the technical term there might be side-eye.
Yes.
Now, I would imagine in the moment, you were probably not aware that this was going to be one of the takeaways of that debate.
The coaching I got from my campaign team, these are really incredible professionals, was don't do that again.
So we should not look for a return.
No, you will not see the return of the side eye unless I'll be standing next to Joe Biden this time.
Okay, gotcha.
So it depends on what...
That wasn't really fair because I also feel like they must tell you, you know, obviously you're watching and you want to be respectful and you want to look at somebody and you did not know you were in a three shot there.
No, I did not.
And now you'll learn, especially right next to Joe Biden. A two shot's easier than a three shot, so you got to be real careful.
You're a few shots beyond me right now.
You talk about, in all seriousness, insofar as we talk about politeness, which will be an interesting thing in this campaign going forward, you talk about civic grace and you talk about courageous empathy. Can you speak a little bit to what you mean by those ideas and also the difficulty in expressing those, in practicing those at a time where the opponent will likely not be using those?
Look, I was running on an Iowa stage, and we were so psyched, hundreds of people there. I'm about to jump up, and this guy sees me, the former tight end from Stanford University. He's a big guy. He puts his arm around me, and he goes, dude, I want you to punch Donald Trump in the face. And I stop in my tracks, and I go, dude, that's a felony, man. Yeah. and you know, Donald Trump is a guy who, you understand, he hurts you. And my testosterone sometimes makes me want to feel like punching him, and which would be bad for this elderly, out of shape man that he is. If I did that, this physically weak specimen, but you see what I'm talking there. Even that's his tactics, and you don't beat a bully like him, fighting him on his tactics, on his terms, using his turf. He's the body shamer. He's the guy that tries to drag people in the gutter. And this is a moral moment in America. And to me, what we need from our next leader, especially after the time of moral vandalism that we're in right now, is we need a leader that's not going to call us to the worst of who we are, but call us to the best of who we are. And we need to be, as a party... in this moral moment, we need not to talk about necessarily what we're against, but what we're for. And the best way of looking at this is just our history. The gardens of our democracy have never been free of the weeds of bigotry, hatred, demagoguery. Every generation has had them. I literally had one elder friend of mine text me saying, listening to Donald Trump's rally last week, that he was talking, the words he was using reminded him of a George Wallace rally that he watched in black and white. Now it's in living color. But how did we beat them before? First of all, don't mistake strength for to be strong, you need to be mean. We beat Bull Connor, for example, in Birmingham, not by bringing bigger dogs and bigger fire hoses and matching his demagoguery with more. But these were incredible artists of activism that called to the moral imagination of a country, that called us to a revival of that civic grace that pulled black folks and white folks and more folks together, that relegated that demagogue to the ash heap of history. We will not beat Donald Trump by trying to be more like him, but by showing that we are not like him. We are not weak morally. We are not weak mentally. We are a strong nation, and we're a nation that unites.
It does seem like, obviously, it's going to be a difficult undertaking for whoever the nominee is to take back the White House. It might even be more statistically difficult for the Democratic Party to take back the Senate. So let's say you're in the White House, but Mitch McConnell is still running the Senate. Where can you find any optimism to think that you can get something done as long as Mitch McConnell, who has been incredibly effective, no matter what you think about him, effective in sort of having this Republican platform that has been a wall that's been impossible to break
through? So that's the distinction of my record. Look, I was a mayor of New Jersey's largest city in the middle of a recession where people told me what we couldn't do. And now from transforming our school system to the biggest period of economic development in 6 years, we got things done people said couldn't be done. I got to the Senate. One of the things that drove me there was the fact that we have one of the most shameful criminal justice systems on the planet, where we say we're the land of the free, but we incarcerate 25% of the globe's incarcerated people. And I went there to do something about it. And I remember people in my own party telling me, you're never going to get legislation like this passed through the United States Senate, especially freeing people from prison at a time in the aftermath of Willie Horton, where everybody's going to be afraid to do that. Well, with Mitch McConnell there, I led from the Democratic side a bill that not only got passed, but right now, last week, we saw thousands of people being released, the overwhelming majority of them being African-Americans.
This is the First Step.
This is the First Step Act. And so I do not resign myself ever to people saying things can't get done. And why I fight so hard in this election, I tell people, I know that the number one thing people want in my party is just to beat Donald Trump. And I'm like, that is a floor. It is not the ceiling. We have to have bigger aspirations. If we make this election all about him, that's a small man, one office. That's not what I want this election to just be about. We will beat him. I will beat him. But we've got to make this more of a movement election to create new American majorities. And I'm not talking about Democratic majorities. But the fact of the matter is, we actually agree on more than we disagree. The lines that divide us, they're not as big as the ties that bind us. And so I think our generation now, in this election, in this moral moment, has to begin not to resign ourselves to fractured, broken government, but aspire to do what our ancestors did. We just came off a weekend where they created the new American majority to defy the limits of human potential and put a person on the moon. It's time for our generation to begin to reject divisive, tribalistic politics and inspire people so that we in our generation can defy gravity as well and do the things that other people think are impossible.
All right, well, thanks for making the time. I know it's got to be busy out there.
Thank you.
Best of luck in the next round of debates. That's Cory Booker, everybody.
If you enjoyed Seth's interview with Cory Booker, be on the lookout for a new episode of the Late Night Podcast on Monday, featuring Senator Booker's extended interview with late night supervising producer Henry Melcher in a new episode of Late Night Cram. Now let's go to Seth and Beto O'Rourke.
Our guest tonight represented Texas's 16th congressional district and was a 2018 Senate candidate. He's now a Democratic candidate for president. Please welcome to the show Beto O'Rourke. How are you?
I'm great.
I'm happy you're here.
I just met Fred Armisen backstage before the show started, and always been a huge fan of his, including a cover that he did of the Clash's cover, Police on My Back. It just blew my mind when I saw it on YouTube. So, honored to be with you, Fred. Yeah.
Yeah, so you, and this is a real thing about you, that you are a great lover of punk rock. You were, in the 90s, a punk rocker. Fair to say?
I'd like to think somewhere inside I still am.
Yeah.
Seth, yeah.
How, do you think the punk rocker that is still inside you is surprised that you, the outside you, is running for president?
Yeah, maybe just a little bit. But I'll tell you, this campaign at its best has a do-it-yourself ethic and spirit. We don't take a dime from a single political action committee or corporation or special interest or lobbyist. It's all people all the time, driving from one town to the next, showing up, telling our story, but listening to the stories of others, which was kind of like touring in a punk rock band in the 1990s, a little bit.
Yeah, probably a nicer car situation.
We were touring in a, we called it the Lumber Wagon. It was a station wagon with four guys, our amps, the drum kit, and maybe one change of clothes per person.
Yeah.
And then on the road for the entire summer. But one of the best ways to spend that part of our lives, and it's still with me.
That's fantastic. I also want to ask, you were in Brooklyn last night doing an event. You used to live in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And is this a true story that you had a trampoline on your roof that you got from Busta Rhymes?
So...
And now again, I... By the way, I get that this is a thing that a lot of candidates have.
Yeah. The answer is yes. So... a roommate of ours, it was either Dylan or Stefan, was working on the set of a Busta Rhymes video.
Uh-huh.
Somehow came home with the trampoline and then managed to assemble it on the roof of the building that we were living on Wallabout Street in Williamsburg in 1996. And it doesn't sound like the safest thing in the world, but here we were jumping on a trampoline on the top of a building. Everyone survived.
I'm sure, by the way, I'm sure Busta Rhymes checked it to make sure it was safe.
Totally.
I mean, if you're going to get one that you can trust for safety, that's it.
Busta Rhymes every time.
I want to ask, because we're coming up next week, another round of these debates. 10 candidates, two different nights. And it does seem like one of the hardest parts is sort of differentiating yourself from other candidates with whom you share a lot, obviously. You ran against Ted Cruz in a Senate campaign. Do you ever miss how easy it was to be different from Ted Cruz? Yeah.
Where is Ted Cruz when you need him?
Yeah, exactly.
You know what?
Very rarely uttered, and yet here we are, yeah.
You know, yeah. Sure. You know what was so great about that campaign in Texas, beyond getting a chance to run against Ted Cruz, was running in a state that had been taken for granted, really written off, ranked 50th in voter turnout. And in addition to getting to debate him, we went to every single one of the 254 counties in that state. So no matter how big or blue, we showed up because we didn't want to take you for granted. No matter how small or red or rural, we showed up there too because we didn't want to write you off. Some places had voted for Donald Trump 96% in the 2016 election. One place, Archer County, that we went to, no candidate from Senate from either party had shown up in 70 years. When LBJ dropped out of the sky in a helicopter in 1948, landed on the courthouse grounds, and walked over to the American Legion Hall. It had been that long since anyone had shown up to listen to them. So that was what was so exciting. And at the end of the day, we turned out in record numbers. Won more votes than any Democrat had in the history of the state of Texas. It was really an extraordinary election.
And you won a lot of, I think it was almost about 500,000 votes of people that voted for Greg Abbott, a Republican, who also voted for you. So, you know, this is, I think, one of the reasons why there was enthusiasm for the idea of you running is maybe you could connect people who don't agree usually with a Democratic candidate. Obviously, there's a scalability question with the United States versus, I mean, again, don't get me wrong, Texas is pretty impressive, but as far as size. But is that your plan here, is just to sort of get wheels down everywhere you can?
Absolutely. That's the consistent theme from being on the road with the guys in the band 25 years ago to being on the road across 254 counties of Texas to this weekend being at the Diving Elk, a great bar in Sioux City, and taking questions from people who were there, introducing myself, and then going to Sioux Center, which is one of the most, if not the most, conservative places in the state of Iowa. And not writing anybody off and not asking, who did you vote for president last time? Or what party do you belong to? Or who do you pray to? Or who do you love? No me importa. I do not care. Just tell me what's important to you right now. We're Americans first before we're anything else. And I got to tell you, in addition to showing up with the courage of our convictions and talking about what we want to see for America, I'm learning so much by listening to people about what's important to them in their lives. And they never ask about polling. They never ask about fundraising. They don't care about the horse race. They want to know how they're going to afford prescription medication or how we're going to get mental health care, not as a function of luck or fortune, but as a human right that every single American can depend on. And I think that's something that unites us across the differences that we have in this country right now.
It strikes me that, you know, from what I know about you, it strikes me that you believe you're someone who thrives in that situation where you can get local with people, you can be in, you know, bars or restaurants talking to them in the places they live. Is it, as you prepare for these debates, especially ones where it'll be you and nine other people on stage, and, you know, short answers, is it frustrating to then take that same message that given the luxury of a little bit more time with people you feel like gets across versus what you'll be up against next week?
Short answer is yes.
Yeah.
It's a very different experience to try to package a really complex policy issue and reflect what you've learned from everyone that you've listened to in America into 60 seconds and then to attempt to do that while nine other people are talking over you simultaneously. And yet that's what we've got to do. That's where we are right now. And my task is to come through as strong and clear as possible to define this as a moment of truth. You've got somebody holding mass rallies saying to send them back. Four members of Congress who happen to be women of color. Someone who is locking up kids in cages, someone who has the deaths of six children who are in our care, in custody on the U.S.-Mexico border, on his hands, on our conscience, we've got to stand up to be counted right now. And I want to make sure that we come through, and this marks the best period going forward for the United States of America, that we stood up to this challenge, we stood up to this bully, and we revealed ourselves to be an ambitious, aspirational people, defined not by fear, but by our courage and our confidence and the resolve that we show in order to accomplish these ambitious goals.
With, I think, one perspective you have that's really unique is obviously, you know, you're from El Paso, it's a border town. And can you speak to what we might all be getting wrong about the border, not just with how Republicans have treated the situation there, but how Democrats have as well?
Yeah. So El Paso, Texas, my hometown, is connected with Ciudad Juarez, and they form the largest binational community in the hemisphere. There's 3 million of us who are joined, not separated, by the Rio Grande River, speaking two languages, coming from these two countries that form something greater than the sum of the people or the parts involved. And El Paso is one of, if not the safest cities in America, not despite, but because it's a city of immigrants and asylum seekers and refugees. So what so many people get wrong right now is thinking that Mexico or Mexicans or immigrants are a threat. Their very presence makes us stronger and safer and more secure. And so if immigration is a problem, it is the best possible problem this country could have. It's time that we rewrite our immigration laws in our own image. Never again cage a child. Reunite those families who've been separated. Free every single dreamer from any fear of deportation. And this becomes a stronger, better, more successful country for it.
So, now, you know what's going to happen, though. Now that you did that, someone else is going to use it at the debate before you.
We gave it away.
I do want to ask this. You know, obviously, it's a crowded field. I do think it's very early, and certainly historically, what we see in polling now is not borne out at the results of any presidential election. We're a ways out. But I think some people have asked. You're obviously this incredibly talented candidate. Certainly those in the Democratic Party said, you're a great congressman. You came really close. Maybe the best use of you isn't here with everybody else because there's all these talented people who are now putting their attention, and obviously only one of them can get a shot. At this, do you ever have doubts and think, oh, maybe this was the wrong thing for me to aim for right now?
No, I never think that. I'm doing what I feel is the most important way for me to contribute to this country's success. Because I don't think that any one person is going to defeat Donald Trump or bring this divided country together again. I think it's really going to take a movement, and a movement that doesn't care if you live in a big city or a small town, if you're an independent, a Democrat, or a Republican, a movement of all of us. And more than 100,000 people have signed up to join this campaign, to volunteer or knock on doors. Hundreds of thousands have donated 5 or 10 or 15 bucks. We have the greatest volunteers in the country working their hearts out right now. And they all know that this is a marathon. And there's going to be highs, there's going to be lows. But through that, we must persist. And it's the only way that we're going to be successful and secure that nomination, defeat Donald Trump, and then meet the ambitions of this country and see these great priorities through once we're in office in 2021.
All right. Well, thanks so much for making
the time
for us.
Thank you. Yeah, appreciate it, sir.
Stay hydrated out there. Better work, everybody. We'll be right back.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
your favorite coffee shop down the street, to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.